When one discusses change and change management, the emphasis tends to be placed on starting something or creating something. In my experience, though, the creation of something must often accompany the destruction of something else, like the breaking of a bad habit. And terminating change efforts is rarely discussed, as though it were unimportant. Oh, don't worry about how this ends. Let's just get started. But stopping something is an important part of change, is it not? My name is Tom Galvin, and these are my reflections on management. In this episode, I am going to tackle one of the biases that is inherent in a lot of the change management literature and in the discussions about change. It's all the emphasis on starting and not on stopping, and all of the emphasis on creating and not on destroying. So it's really two biases, but they really do have kind of the same, come from the same vein, in that we emphasize creation much more than destruction. Now, of course, we want change efforts to make things better for our organizations. There is a lot to be said about terminating bad habits or eliminating destructive behaviors from an organization. What's an example of a bad habit that we would want to eliminate? Certainly one is overladen bureaucracy, the ossification of a process or system to the point where the organization is dealing with significant inflexibility and inability to change. That's a fairly straightforward thing, one that is commonly desired. After all, nobody wants organizations to have behaviors, attitudes, processes, whatever, that are unwanted, unnecessary, morally or ethically unacceptable, inefficient, obsolete, otherwise detracting from performance. I mean, there's any number of reasons why we would want to stop doing something that doesn't make sense. I think there's a reason why perhaps the bias is so strong towards creation rather than destruction, simply because no matter how undesirable a process or a system is, there's some part of the organization that is invested in it for some reason. I mean, if the process wasn't satisfying a need, it wouldn't have been created in the first place. When we talk about things like an unneeded reporting requirement, or meetings that seem to no longer be necessary, or other processes that outlive their usefulness, there's something at risk if we were just to simply say, we'll eliminate it. There's somebody who needs the information or relies on the information who would have to, you know, come up with another way of getting that information. Now, let me give you three concrete examples, because I think this would help. Although all three of them are perhaps military examples, I hope that the three kind of show some equivalence or some corresponding relationship in other types of organizations. The first is one I discussed just a few episodes ago. It's called the use-it-or-lose-it mentality, in which an organization, in an attempt to preserve its budget, spends all of its remaining money before the end of the fiscal year instead of transferring it to another program. I've already spoke at length about that, so with respect to how it can be a wasteful practice and one that certainly the U.S. military wants to stop, but it is hard. Another is excess training requirements. This is essentially a case where training requirements, in order to remain certified or to remain current in everything one needs to be able to do one's job, accumulate to the point where it's totally unmanageable, and that the training requirements exceed available time or become an incredible disruption to the organization's mission. We went through a few years ago a case where mandatory training was being significantly scrutinized within the United States military because all sorts of things were being added and added to the training requirements. But that's not confined to the military. Certainly, there's training administrative requirements that are being added for teachers. And it includes all of the things that we would want people to be able to put into practice, such as cultural awareness, equal opportunity, you know, all those sorts of things. But too much becomes too much, and it becomes disruptive to the mission. So the tendency to just simply add new requirements as new needs arise had not been adequately countered by a critical evaluation of how much was being asked in such requirements. We needed to reduce. We needed to be smarter about what we're asking for. There's also examples of inclusion and representation, matters in which I discussed a couple episodes ago in the post-diversity vision, in which essentially, you know, discriminatory practices had to be eliminated. But those are hard, not because people want to continue discriminating, but because there are second and third order effects of the activities meant to open up service that have to be accounted for. This is what makes sometimes stopping bad habits much more difficult to do than you would think. You would think that, well, of course we want to eliminate discrimination. We just sign it away with a pen. Well, no, unfortunately, it isn't that easy. And I think for that reason, you know, I started thinking about, well, what can help me better understand? What can help me think through those sorts of change efforts where the entire change effort is associated with eliminating a bad habit? I'm just going to offer that the theory that I have used for this to understand it is institution theory. And I'm mostly using W. Richard Scott's book, Institutions and Organizations. And he draws in a whole bunch of literature as he describes, his depiction of both the three pillars of institution, which is the formal regulative, the normative, and the cognitive pillars. But what I really find useful is how he brings together both the processes of institutionalization and deinstitutionalization, which a number of scholars have contributed thoughts. What I want to do is focus a bit more on the deinstitutionalization. And a lot of this is drawn from the work of Tamar Zilber. Christine Oliver is another source. And these scholars have taken a good hard look at what it takes to cause a institutional practice to weaken and wither away. And I think that kind of language is very different than just stopping, because when we think of stopping, it's as simple as just stop doing this, you know, just outlaw it or make it against regulation and people will stop doing it. And of course, it never really works that simply. There's a lot more to it, because something that is embedded as an institutional practice has not only formed formally, but there are norms and obligations associated with it, and the cultural, the deeper mentality of what makes some practice become a habit. Those have to be influenced in some way in order for a deinstitutionalization to occur. Now, I don't have time to go over the entire model which they developed, but let me just sort of highlight some of the things that they considered. For example, the weakening begins with different types of pressures, or a combination of pressures placed upon the practice, listed as competitive, functional, and social. You know, the competitive is about how the legitimacy is called into question. So if we think that, for example, a report or some training requirement is excessive, then it basically, the legitimacy of it is brought to question. So people start questioning it, and then the practice becomes weaker. Functional pressures would be sort of like a cost-benefit analysis. This is too burdensome. We need to stop doing this. And social pressures is if the organization becomes essentially divided over the practice, where those who are invested in a practice are so invested that they will retain it at all costs in the face of other segments of the organization who say that this is a bad idea, we got to stop doing it. Those kind of pressures can then cause the foundation of the practice to weaken. So when we think about starting the process of stopping doing something, those are three avenues that can kind of say, get at the unfreezing aspects of, you know, invoking Kurt Lewin's model of change. What gets the organization loosened up to consider disbanding a particular practice? Can you call the practice as being a direct threat to the legitimacy of the organization? Cost-benefit analysis, or is it becoming a divisive factor? Those are ways of expressing, say, the urgency of getting rid of the practice. And then what the scholars talk about then is that as it weakens, you end up with two different sets of pressures, one of which are oriented towards keeping the practice going, and it's referred to as inertial pressures. And there are others that just simply add to the weakening of the foundation, called entropic pressures. Now, entropic pressures, some examples of that would be things that cause the practice to wither away on its own because people forget why this practice was put into effect. People are, personnel turnover are causing people to forget how to do things. Things get messed up. Or that there's a failure to engage with stakeholders, that the stakeholders are no longer interested in what the organization's reports are. That can help continue to weaken the foundation such that it becomes dissipated and eventually rejected. Inertial pressures are things that might have to be countered because we're talking here about things like the investment into the practice that is just too much to overcome, or there's a desire for predictability and continuity that if we forgo this particular practice, what's going to replace it? How is the organization going to change elsewhere? I mean, those sorts of fears have to be overcome. Now, we can think of one form of inertial pressure being resistance. Certainly, individuals who are actively opposed to the dissipation of a practice can take steps to get in the way. That's one form of inertial pressure. But another one is just environmental, in which the industry perhaps is maintaining a particular practice, and there's a desire to stay in line with how everybody else is doing business, even though you may reject the practice yourself. So ultimately, what you're looking for is to encourage or enable the entropic pressures to overcome the inertial pressures until essentially you see the dissipation or the rejection of the practice as a fait accompli. Now, the example that I like to use is the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. This was about the integration of gays and lesbians into the military. For a long time in the United States, they were excluded. So then the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law was meant to provide an avenue for gays and lesbians to serve so long as they kept their orientation private. In the wake of operations in the past 15 years, there was a recognition that there were gays and lesbians who were serving, who were known to be gay and lesbian, but their personal performance and their ability to accomplish the mission was on par with their peers, and it showed to be somewhat of a non-issue. Certainly different than what was perceived in previous times. Military leaders enacted pressures, political, competitive, and otherwise, to suggest that the law no longer had a purpose. Now, on the one hand, the law could have been changed by legislature alone. Could have been done very formally. But that would have been a bit disruptive, or it was perceived to have been a bit disruptive, and it wasn't entirely known what the impacts would be of just a sudden change in the law. So instead, they undertook a process that was deinstitutionalizing. And it was a matter of going around and engaging, high-level leaders, going around the military, engaging with service members on their views. And it served a rather interesting purpose because it provided those pressures to try to weaken the case that the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law needed to be retained on the books. But it also allowed for norms and attitudes towards gays and lesbians to be brought out into the open, such that there was reaffirmation, hey, this law needs to just go away. It's not serving a purpose. It's not consistent with our experiences. So that sort of melted away a lot of the resistance. It melted away a lot of the inertial pressures that could have come to the fore in resistance against the elimination of the law. And so then the end result, I mean, oversimplifying, but the end result was that the law was in fact repealed, but it was repealed rather quietly. Just nothing happened. I mean, there was no active resistance left. It was just simply gone and life went on. So I like to use that as an example of how a change effort can be done to stop doing something that we want the organization to stop doing as the result of the entire change effort. That's not to say that this is easy. I mean, the socialization process was fairly extensive. It was time consuming and involved very, very high level leaders. But the fact that it was successful, I think, is an indication that perhaps that there is more to deliberate change than creating something. Stopping an unwanted practice or eliminating an attitude that we don't want is certainly worth the same amount of attention as starting something. And that's all for now. The views expressed are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States Army War College, the United States Army, or the Department of Defense. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.